AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. Biden addresses the nation. I'm Daria Albinger, passing the torch to a new generation.
I've given my heart and my soul to our nation, like so many others. I've been blessed a million times in return with the love and support of the American people. I hope you have some idea how grateful I am to all of you.
President Biden explaining his decision not to seek re-election in an address from the Oval Office. ABC's Karen Travers.
The White House also said today that the president's decision to not run for re-election was not because of his health, despite all of the speculation over the past couple of weeks after that debate performance in late June, which he acknowledged was a bad night. He didn't say it explicitly tonight, but what he was acknowledging here was the concession that he recognized that he was not likely to win this race.
He says he has a job to do and he plans to do it. This is ABC News.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Last we knew, an armed and dangerous man was still on the loose in the Baraboo area. Savannah Tomei Olson reports.
It started with an attempted traffic stop. That led to a chase, stop sticks, then a crash. Baraboo police say the man started shooting at them, then ran into the woods. One deputy has a minor injury. There was a shelter-in-place order that's since been lifted. The suspect is 32-year-old Jeffrey Edward Miller, with brown, short, or shaved hair and a medium-length beard with tattoos on his face. If you see him, call 911.
Savannah Tomei Olson reporting. A safety reminder for ATV and UTV riders. 20 people have died in recreational vehicle crashes in Wisconsin this year. Last year, 95% of fatal crash victims were not wearing a helmet. Wardens say remember to wear safety equipment. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Well, hi there. It's the fabulous Farm Bay Pam Yonke bringing you the Midwest Farm Report live weekday mornings right here on WBZH. It's not just for farmers. It's for anybody that loves food. Tune in 5 a.m. on the Buzz of the North, 910 a.m. Hayward.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 a.m. WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Newsweek had a headline. Joe Biden is one of the worst presidents in history. One in five Democrats say. And look, when did Newsweek become this kind of clickbaiting rag? When did that happen? Now, they used a Rasmussen poll. Yeah, I don't know why you would, I don't know why anyone would use a Rasmussen poll. It is, they describe it as Republican leading. No, it's fully in the bag. This is where you go to go, hey, I want to come up with the craziest nonsense possible. So get me a poll to confirm the most outrageous, crazy nonsense possible. Or at least that's the way it appears. But here's the thing. You're going to see this. You're going to see this kind of rhetoric coming out of the right because they have to. Because understand, history is going to be really kind to Joe Biden. When you think about all of the things that he had to wade through, the fact that in the first time in the history of our country, you had a contested transfer of power, a blood-filled transfer of power. One of the great things about this country had always been that we were the beacon of the world. We showed the world how you can have ideological transfers of power without blood loss. Well, thanks to Donald Trump and the Republicans, that is no longer our legacy. It's no longer true. That is our past. And Joe Biden is taking us, fortunately, back in that direction. His legacy, quite frankly, is going to be the enormous amount of legislation and the transformational changes that were made during his short tenure. That's the reality. His legislation of, to rebuild this country. Granted, it's nowhere near what we needed, but it's what we could get. You know, it's that bipartisanship that people talk about. Oh, well, we got bipartisanship. Well, out of bipartisanship, you know what we got? We got a quarter of what we needed. And this is where the rest of us have got to come around to the reality that one of the parties, they don't seem to really care about the country that much. They care about themselves. So that infrastructure bill that got a handful of Republicans to come on board, and good for them, should have been much chunkier, should have been much bigger, should have been much more helpful, should have been a bigger shot in the arm for the economy. And you know, that's the weird thing. That's the reason they didn't do it, because it would have been a massive win. Look, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill is a massive win. Can you imagine the $3.5 trillion that they wanted, or the $4.8 trillion that we needed? Can you imagine what that would have done for the country? No, but Rick, that would have caused inflation. No, to put people back to work and in good career-sustaining jobs. And then we wouldn't be questioning immigration. We'd be begging people to come here to do the jobs that need to be done. But again, can't talk about that. Also, the idea that we have an industrial policy and that we're actually reindustrializing the nation in ways that, both of these, in ways that won't be seen for another decade or two. But when history looks back, it's going to be very, very, very positive. Now, I think the reality is, I think Biden's downfall was the inflation. The rest of the world suffering under much, much worse inflation. But we as Americans, we're insulated. We don't care about the rest of the world. We care about ourselves, me. And inflation has been hard on working people. There's no question about it. And from the beginning, I kept saying, look, it's not Biden's fault. There's no switch in the Oval Office that goes inflation on, inflation off. There's not. There's policies. There's things we should and could be doing. But ultimately, the invisible hand of the market that the right says they love so much, that has something to do with it, especially when the invisible hand is planted firmly in your pocket, robbing you blind. Because we now find out, you may remember back in April, I think we talked about this, that the Federal Trade Commission put out a report that, surprise, surprise, found that the big grocery chains, the supply chain folks, the people who bring us our food, the people who do all of this stuff that we buy, they were gouging us. They were taking advantage of the situation, because you're going, hey, well, you need it. You're going to buy it anyway, and we're going to gouge you with it. Now, look, the report, according to the New York Times, found that some large firms accelerated and distorted the effects of the supply chain snarls, including by pressuring suppliers to favor them over competition. Now, this is an FTC violation. This is something, as I was saying back then, maybe we should be looking into this stuff, bringing these CEOs in, grilling them in public, and having the message of, hey, we're trying to fight inflation by going after these greedy you-know-whats. Now, what's interesting, and we're going to talk about this later in the show as well, what's interesting is we created some really big billionaires. You think about Elon Musk, who before the pandemic was worth about $20 billion. A lot of money, most certainly, without question, lots of money. After pandemic, $258 billion. Little difference. Bezos, same kind of thing. $83 billion before the pandemic, $216 after. Zuckerberg, $72 billion before the pandemic, $187 after. Buffett, $81 billion before, $131 after. And these are billions with a B, lots of zeros. And how did that happen? Happened a couple of ways. Corporations are lining their pockets. Bigger stock, bigger payouts to their CEOs, lower taxes, more for them, less for everybody else. And what I haven't heard, where are my Tea Party folks who during the Tea Party years were screaming, redistribution of wealth? Because we just lived through and are living through a massive redistribution of wealth from the people who work for a living and create the products and the wealth that, the very wealthy get to line their pockets with. And you go, but Rick, what could we have done? Well, we could start by taxing them. We could dig up the policies of the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, back to a 92% top marginal tax rate. We could raise the minimum wage, which oddly enough, today, 15 years ago, today was the last time the federal minimum wage was raised. Still, 15 years later, $7.25 an hour. And there are 20 states, the state that I live in, Pennsylvania, among them, who have not raised the minimum wage. And you go, but you know, it's a states' rights issue, Rick. No, no. At some point, the floor has to be raised for everyone. And this is what the federal government should be doing. But we're not, because our government has been hijacked by crazy. Our government has been hijacked by people who hate government, who don't want to do anything. And the people who fund them and put them in those positions don't want anything because they're happy. Why? Because they're lining their pockets. A dysfunctional government like we have, what we get to see every day, is really great for rich people. Not so good for workers. Not so good for working families. Seems simple to me. Want to hear your thoughts. Are you in one of those 20 states that hasn't raised the minimum wage since 2009? I know here in Pennsylvania, it's still $7.15, the state minimum wage. I remember the chant, $7.15, nothing in between. Yeah, quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, got to tell you, I'm pleasantly surprised at how fast my friends in the labor movement are moving to get behind a candidate. We're in unprecedented times. You got a guy who's running on the Republican side who was really bad, but I got to tell you, it's encouraging to see the kind of movement and momentum. I look at the statement by Culinary Secretary Treasurer Ted Papageorge, who said President Biden is a champion of workers, and under his leadership, the most pro-union policies have been implemented. He went on to say the NLRB has held employers like Station Casino accountable, and his plan to cap rent increases and protect working families stands in stark contrast to Trump Republicans who refuse to take on price gouging Wall Street landlords, big corporations, and the super rich. Sean Fain, head of the UAW, the path forward is clear. We will defeat Donald Trump and his billionaire agenda and elect a champion for the working class to the highest office. And on Monday, the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades endorsed Kamala Harris for the Democratic nomination for president, and Jimmy Williams Jr., the general president there at IUPAT, is here to share some thoughts. Jimmy, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So I got to tell you, in looking at how fast things have moved, I'll tell you, I didn't think the labor movement could move this fast.
Hey, we don't have much time to wait. We have 105 days till Election Day. And I think the labor movement's reaction was just like the reaction you're seeing throughout the Democratic Party was, we got to unite. We have to unite to beat what is, without a doubt, the biggest threat to the American working class in a generation, which is a second Donald Trump administration. We cannot take our eyes off the prize.
No, I'm right there with you. But I think we have historic amnesia in this country, because I think a lot of people, especially a lot of my union friends that I've been talking to, they don't remember how bad things were for unions during the Trump administration. They don't remember that the head of the general counsel of the NLRB was a guy who was instrumental in firing the Patco workers. There's a lot that we've seemed to have forgotten. And I think taking a couple of minutes and going, you know, it was bad, especially from a position where you're in.
It wasn't just bad then. It's how bad it's going to be into the future, too. Just taking a look at the fact that when Donald Trump was elected, number one, I don't think he ever thought he was going to win, but he did. He wasn't prepared to lead right off the get. And 2/3, if not more, of the people he had around him left him before the end of the administration. And he was left with some of the craziest people that I could ever remember working in government. Those folks have abandoned him. A Donald Trump coupled with Project 2025 is scary for all American workers, but specifically for us union members and us union leaders.
No, and this is, you know, I said this a while ago. Look, you know, the machinery that wants to destroy our government and what our country has become, all of these right-wing think tanks, the state policy networks, all of the moneyed interest, mechanisms, they didn't think Trump was going to win either. So they didn't prepare to have a transition and to push policy through right away. And to our good fortune, Trump wasn't really interested in any of that. Now I see, since you brought up Project 2025, it's the moneyed interest with all of their machinery, putting all of their wealth, their weight, their power, all of their evil mind control power into one 900-page document on how to make this country, well, the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s again.
And that's how they're going to govern if elected. And they've made that very clear. The Republican Party of today is not even the Republican Party of 2016. You have to remember, when Donald Trump cleared the field in 2016, you had some serious, serious competition. They're all gone. They've either gone or they've just fallen in line. And that is who's going to govern this country if the American working class doesn't unite behind Vice President Harris.
Yeah. Now, you, I'm sure you watched the RNC convention. One of the surprising moments there for me was Nikki Haley coming forth and giving an endorsement, given the fact that they had a pretty hot and heavy primary, but also the fact that ideologically she's just not there. I was kind of surprised to see her, of all people, fall in line. You know, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, the rest, DeSantis, the rest of them, I get that, but she surprised me.
Nothing surprises me anymore, Rick. There hasn't been a single Republican, with the exception of Dick Cheney's daughter, which is crazy, and maybe Mitt Romney, that have ever had the nerve to really stand up and want to remain in public office, because they've all had to fall in line behind former President Trump. That's just the way that party has operated.
Now, the National Review has said something that I find interesting. And again, the National Review is not a hippie liberal publication. One of the long, longstanding extreme conservative publications. They said that Trump's appeal to union members like yours, was not ideological. It was cultural, that they really don't know what it is that he wants to do. Then they don't really care, because it's a cultural thing. It's about the outrage. It's about the anger. It's about what talk radio has been feeding them and cable news, and not really what his agenda is. Do you find that to be accurate and something that you find in your members? And if that's so, how are you combating that?
Yeah, I agree with that 1,000%. And, you know, we've been talking to our members. And when we talk to our members, it's obvious that it's not about the issues sometimes, and that these cultural divides that have been used to pit working people against one another, they're real. We have to acknowledge that. And we really do. And what's on the ballot now with the stark contrast between having the first ever, you know, woman, person of color nominated to lead as the top of the ticket against Donald Trump. We're going to decide what the American future is going to look like in November. And listen, I will always stand on the side of unity, on inclusion, on standing side by side with people of color, with women, with folks from all backgrounds, because I really do believe that Donald Trump has tapped into the worst amongst the working class by tapping into people's fears about immigrant workers, about people of color, about women. You know, that has been the agenda from day one, to scare people into being outraged versus uniting people.
And, you know, as I've been watching the dog whistling and just the outright everything that you've pointed out, the attacks on policies that have you know, they've deemed basically racist. It's interesting to watch the right do this kind of this dance without saying what they want to say out loud. They use coded language. And sadly, we haven't done enough. I don't think we've done a good enough job calling them out on it.
Hey, we have to. We cannot allow in this election for the same thing to happen in 2016, where there was definitely a dog whistle about having a woman lead this country. Same thing as the dog whistle that was sounded by former President Trump before he was ever elected with some of his racist remarks about President Obama. We can't allow that to happen this time. We just can't.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. So, you know, I said from the beginning after the Thursday debate with President Biden that I believe he's going to do what's in the best interest of the country. I fully believe in Joe Biden. I think he more than anything is a patriot and someone who history will look very kindly on because of this decision, because it's going to give us a chance to save the country from the kind of a future that I fear a Trump presidency will bring us. I wanted to give you a minute to kind of look back over these last 3.5 years and go, you know, what will be Joe Biden's legacy? How will our grandchildren remember him?
I think it goes beyond just the last 3.5 years. I mean, Joe Biden's public service has been there from the minute he decided to take office way back in the 1970s. And when you really think about Joe Biden's legacy, it looks, in my opinion, it's twofold. You know, number one, he stood aside in 2016 to allow for a historic nominee in Hillary Clinton to run for office. You know, he was vice president of the United States then. And he allowed for the Democratic Party to unite behind the first woman candidate to run for president at the time. He's done it a second time. And that just shows you the type of values that Joe Biden has personally. But when you look at his legacy as president of the United States, it is unparalleled for working people. He has reversed the trend of trickle-down economics that has been there since Reagan took office in 1980. He has put in more things to help working people achieve a real chance at getting ahead in this country. And he has done it through policy. He has done it through legislation, and he has done it in his actions and who he is as a person, that we, this country will recognize Joe Biden as not only the best union president of my lifetime, but also probably one of the best statesmen we've ever had in our country.
No, clearly he was the right guy at the right moment, because one of the things I give him the utmost credit for is being able to tap down some of the anger and some of the real heavy divisiveness. And I give him credit for that. He was the right guy in the right moment. And I hope you're right. I hope history does remember him kindly and for the investments and the things that we will be seeing going forward. Unfortunately, inflation was, I think, the big downfall here, and I wish they would have done what I wanted them to do from the very beginning, was to enact some kind of the old Truman commissions or a commission to go after price gouging that we now look back and go, yeah, the big grocery chains, you know, they gouged our eyes out, not because they had to, but because they could and they wanted to and they lined their pockets. That's the only thing that I think I would have changed.
Yeah, I mean, listen, every president and every leader is always second guessed. But when you think about what this country's response to a global supply chain problem was. Joe Biden doubled down on the American worker by creating more jobs in the manufacturing setting and in the global supply chain. We have outperformed most countries. And you got to give them credit for building those types of jobs as the American response to what has been a global problem with inflation.
No, I'm right there with you. I want to pivot back real quick because I want to make sure that we understand going forward that there are two very differences. There are two very different parties, different ideologies, different directions, and different effects for working people. And Republicans have, you know, through the Heritage Foundation, written down what their beliefs are. They have a platform they've written down for us to read. They have told us what they want to do. And I look at you as someone in the building trades, and on what I think it's page 604, 605, they want to do away with prevailing wage, and they want to do away with project labor agreements. Those are things that I think, and maybe we can disagree, but I think those are things that are kind of important to your members, aren't they?
Yeah, I would say so. They're the pillar of you know, our, what it looks like to work in the construction industry in a dignified way. And they're the things that keep wages from being, you know, dropped down to next to nothing or whatever your employer wants to pay you. And yeah, they are the basic fundamental principles about why we engage with government in the building trades. But it goes so far beyond that. You know, the things that they plan to do, you know, goes well beyond just what they're going to do to building trades unions. Their attempt to try to eliminate the union movement is real, and it's written down, and you know that that's going to be the plan of attack.
And, you know, it goes back to, do we believe in that ideal of the past, of the Knights of Labor, an injury to one being an injury to all? Because it's interesting that I've gotten a number, since the RNC convention, I've gotten a number of responses from union people going, well, you know, I'm all in favor of public sector unions, just not those government unions. And I think the Republicans have done a very good job of dividing and attempting to conquer, especially in the labor movement. Because Trump has already said he wants to fire, 50,000 federal employees through this Schedule F. They've got this grand plan, Project 2025, to make patronage great again. Do you think that message is getting out that this is the direction they want to take work in America?
No, I don't think it has. And I think because, sadly, the corporate interests, I think, sadly, the media has focused on the wrong issues. And I think, thankfully, President Joe Biden did the right thing by saying, you know what? It's not about me. It's about the issues. And I think the response from both the labor movement and from working people and from just general Americans that have had enough of this type of debate in this country behind uniting behind Vice President Harris right now, and the amount of energy that you see right now in the base of the Democratic Party and amongst people saying, you know what, I really think we can pull together as a country, is exciting to see, because that's the real debate we have to have, Rick. And we haven't been allowed to have it because it's been about two people's personalities. And now it's about time we get back on track and talking about the real issues.
So what in your world, what is that focus issue that you want Kamala Harris to hold on to? Is it today being the 15th anniversary of the last time we raised the minimum wage? Is it the prevailing wage? Is it the project labor agreements? Is it the right to collective bargaining? Or is it all of it? Is it what built the most prosperous working class in humanity and the mere existence of the 20th century not being repealed? Is that what we fight for?
I'll tell you what, Rick. You know what it starts with? It starts with finishing the job, right? All of the accomplishments that President Biden has been able to achieve has to see its way to the finish line. This economy that is being built as we speak through the middle class outward has to have time to develop. You know, a lot of the jobs and the projects in the construction industry have yet to even get started. And I can only tell our members, imagine what it would look like under a Trump administration if those jobs do not have prevailing wage standards, if they do not have project labor agreements, if they do not have apprenticeship programs. Guess what? Forget it.
Yeah.
We don't stand a chance. It starts there.
No, it's an excellent point. Excellent point.
But the promise of doing even more to unite the country and to really develop and get off of these divisive moments that we've had since 2016, you know, that's something also that we should all be focused on.
I'm right there with you. Jimmy Williams Jr., I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good on you. I look forward to talking to you again here in the near future.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much, Jimmy Williams Jr., General President of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, IUPAT.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Maybe even, sign up for their apprenticeship program, become one of these high-paid, career building trades guys. It's a good job. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to WBZH, Hayward's home for the Todd Allbald Show.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. You may need a jacket outdoors in the overnight as low temperatures will bottom out in the upper 40s. Clear skies, a little patchy fog will be possible. After that burns off, sunny to mostly sunny skies. Thursday afternoon's high will reach the lower 80s. It's 57 at our studios.
Matt Nair on air.
Don Ellingson is our guest. He's one of the co-directors of the Eau Claire Coupe League.
It's a Swedish yard game. You would toss a baton trying to knock down your opponent's coupes.
You have teams from all over the country. What are some of the other names that stuck out to you?
Coupe Hand Luke.
Nice. Yeah.
The Salty Baton.
Oh. Do you call the last 16 teams the Swedish 16?
Oh, I'm writing that down. That's pretty good.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as we talked about at the top of the hour, rich people got really richer. Pre-pandemic, rich. Post-pandemic, oh my God, rich. In fact, so rich, we have a major, major breaking accomplishment news bit. Our billionaire class, the people that we created, now officially worth $6 trillion. And I think there should be a celebration, a cookie at least, but some bit of happiness, some national celebration, maybe mark it as a day of remembrance, a big holiday. Because after all, look, a lot of starving children, a lot of veterans living on the streets, a lot of homeless families, they went without so that we could help this wealth class reach this plateau. Look, this is historic stuff. As were my grandparents' generation, their pride was ensuring that, you bought a little house, a little white picket fence, car in the driveway every couple of years, 2.3 kids, mom stays home, one income supports a family. That's what gave them pride. Us, we got a billionaire class, the biggest billionaire class ever. And here to share some thoughts on just maybe how we got here and maybe how we fix this, I've asked my good friend Will Rice to come talk with us. Will is a policy consultant for the good folks over at Americans for Tax Fairness, AmericansForTaxFairness.org, the website. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
So congratulations, Will. You, me, our audience, everyone, we tightened the belt a little bit, sacrificed a little bit, bought the store brand instead of the name brand, just so we could have this wonderful honor.
Right. And I know the billionaires would certainly appreciate celebration. They like to be congratulated for what they've accomplished, even though what they've accomplished depends a lot on what you and I do on the public highways and the public ports and the courts of law and the law enforcement and everything else that's a collective effort. They benefit from that. They don't pay all that much in taxes to support it, but it helps them reach milestones like $6 trillion.
It is quite an accomplishment we have gotten, I got to tell you. And look, I am being facetious here, but in reality, The fact that they've gotten to $6 trillion and we still aren't going marching in the streets with pitchforks and tiki torches or whatever, with big signs like Sean Fain's shirt going "Eat the Rich" is mind-blowing. The fact that we're still pointing our fingers at hungry children and single family homes is just amazing to me.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I'm not sure I would be out there with the pitchforks, but I certainly I spend my time trying to figure out how we can spread this wealth around a little better through fairer taxes on billionaires and other hyper wealthy people.
Yeah.
And I think the more people are aware of how incredibly unbalanced our economy has become, how much money is way up there at the top of the pyramid, the more people will get interested in this whole issue of tax fairness. It's already very popular if you do polling, but I want more people to know some of the details about how we can make our tax system fairer, thereby spread some of that wealth and return us more to a democracy and become less of a plutocracy.
There you go. Now, you guys put out a social media post that said Elon Musk in 2017 was worth $20 billion. A lot of money, still a lot of money. But after the pandemic, 2024, holy, $258 billion. There's part of me that goes, I want to get a shovel and go dig up Dwight Eisenhower, our last good socialist Republican president, and reenact his tax code because it looks like we need it.
Yeah. What we really need, though, actually, is because billionaires make their money differently than we do. We obviously know they have a lot more of it, but they also live differently. They make their money differently. And our tax code is currently structured, isn't terribly good at taxing the way billionaires make their money. And I should point out, you said 2017. What's significant about that date is that that's when the Trump GOP tax law was passed. And that was a law passed entirely by Republicans, no Democratic votes, that was heavily slanted towards the wealthy and big corporations. And since that law passed, billionaire wealth has doubled. It was a little under $3 trillion back then. Now it's $6 trillion.
So I guess the thanks is to Donald Trump then. We have this now wonderful national pride of these very wealthy billionaires. Now, granted, you know, we need money for roads and bridges and education and healthcare and to put food on the table and ensure that people can put clothes on their kids' back and, you know, save for retirement because a couple of generations are going to go into retirement with nothing saved. But hey, we've got this great accomplishment. So is that the reason, or is there more to it than just Trump, or is this all Trump's credit?
No, he can't take all the credit, although I know he will. And of course, he's benefited from this as a member of the billionaire class. But some of the parts of his law that definitely contributed to this was they lowered the top tax rate that you paid on ordinary income. And when you have as much income as they do, that's a big deal. They cut, more importantly, they cut the corporate tax rate by 2/5. And a lot of this wealth, the great bulk of it, I would imagine, is made up of corporate stock. So these are the owners of corporations. So when you cut the corporate tax rate, you're cutting the tax rate of billionaires. So they also made it, they made it cheaper to earn your corporate profits overseas rather than here, which both reduces our tax revenue and endangers American jobs. So there were a lot of things in the Trump tax law that contributed to this dubious milestone, but there were other stuff that was in effect even before that came along that also contributed.
Yeah, our tax code's been broken for a very, very long time. The fact that, you know, Biden was talking about raising taxes on these people should be a reason that we rallied behind him. Sadly, didn't hear the message. But you were talking about the corporate tax rate, and, you know, just earlier today I was reading a story that said, you know, the 8 largest pharmaceutical companies in this country paid zero in U.S. corporate taxes last year. And I'm going, how is that possible? They're making billions of dollars. How is it possible they're paying zero? How is it our laws are that bad that they're paying literally nothing?
The problem is that corporations are allowed to figure their profits in two ways. They do it one way to come up with a figure that they flash to Wall Street to try to attract investors. And of course, they want that number to be as high as possible. Then they're allowed to figure it a different way when they're calculating their taxes. And that's when they want to poor mouth what they have to the IRS. So President Biden took note of that. And one of the many accomplishments of his administration was that he passed a corporate minimum alternative tax, which says if you're one of the top 100 companies in the country and you're not paying at least 15%, you have to figure your taxes again based on that big number you tell Wall Street about and then pay that amount. So he's been trying to address this issue, but it's not just pharmaceuticals. There's all kinds of big corporations that, especially since the Trump GOP tax law, have announced big profits and little or no in taxes.
Now, as I understand, what is it, next year, a lot of the Trump tax code sunsets, especially those parts that actually maybe had some bit of benefit for working people. Do you see those things being expanded? Do you see those going by the wayside? Any thoughts on what the future might hold for those?
What should happen is the parts of that law that actually were of some help to working people, like the expanded child tax credit and the expanded deductions, standard deduction, we should keep those. And in fact, President Biden and now Kamala Harris, part of his team, and now apparently going to be the next Democratic presidential candidate, have made this pledge that they're not going to allow any tax law, parts of the tax law expire that would increase taxes for anyone making less than $400,000 a year. But there's plenty of stuff we can let expire that helps people above that amount and far above that amount and save trillions of dollars in tax revenue that we can then invest in education, healthcare, housing, childcare, all the things that help working people get by and get ahead.
Yeah, I remember as they were debating this back in 2017, I questioned the sense in sunsetting things like the child tax credit and the things that working people wanted while making permanent the corporate tax breaks and the breaks for the wealthy. I kind of questioned which side Donald Trump was choosing to be on, because understand, they sold it as working people are going to get a tax cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the main thing was the main aim of this law was to cut the corporate tax rate. But Republicans know enough about the American people and where things stand now. They knew they couldn't get away with just doing a corporate tax cut. So they put these other elements in as well. But the part that they made permanent was the corporate part. And the part that they made temporary were these things that some of them, yes, helped working families. The majority of it, though, helps higher income people. And they figured if we mash them together, we'll sneak in these rich tax cuts along with the middle class ones. But the Democrats are wise to that. And it's going to be a big battle at the end of next year, or actually all through next year, leading up to the end of the year, where Democrats are not only saying, no, don't extend these tax cuts for the rich people, but let's make this an opportunity to have some real tax reform. And there's a lot of things we could throw in there that would make the tax code fairer, would raise more money for us so we can invest in the American people, and would decrease somewhat the power of billionaires and other hyper-wealthy people.
I'm glad you brought that up, because look, there's a way of doing a much more progressive tax code, kind of like I jokingly said during the good socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower's era, where there were multiple brackets. The more money you made, the higher your tax rate went, all the way up to the very top of a 92% top marginal tax rate. But you look at what Trump did and the numbers, they lowered the numbers on rich people. The corporate tax he lowered from, 35 down to 20, 21, wants to go down to 15. And you've got this Project 2025 plan that is out there saying, no, we want to simplify the tax code by basically creating two flat tax brackets. And it appears to me, and I'm not a tax expert, I'm just a guy who looks at simple numbers and goes, what they're proposing is a massive tax increase on the vast majority of the working class. Have you read through these tax proposals in this Project 2025? And if you have, what are we seeing in it?
Well, as I said, it's something I wrote for our Substack. It's probably the biggest collection of bad tax ideas ever in one place at the same time. I mean, they have both short and long-term goals, and the short-term goals include what you say, cutting the top tax rate that the richest people pay down to 30% from where it is now, rather than raising it, which is what most Americans want. They also want to reduce the corporate tax rate even further, as you said, like Trump wants to, down to 15%. And then longer term, they want to do things like eliminate the or replace the income tax with a national sales tax. And that's about the most regressive kind of tax you can have, because if you're a working person, you spend much more of your money on absolute necessities like groceries and gas. And so you're paying tax on that. Whereas if you're a wealthy person, you don't have to spend so much on those necessities, and you're going to wind up with a huge tax cut if you get that. So Project 2025 is a terrible idea for working Americans. It's a terrible idea for almost everyone except for the very richest people in our country.
Because you laid it out there a little bit in that what they've put a line at $168,000, evidently. If you make over $168,000, you'd be paying 30% federal taxes. Mm-hmm. And if you make under that, you're going to pay 15%. You know, if we learned anything from Mitt Romney during his presidential run, a good percentage of people don't pay federal taxes. So this would be a massive increase on the lower end of the working class, wouldn't it?
Yeah, for most people, in fact, workers who make over $100,000 a year, they pay more in payroll taxes than they do in income taxes. So when you're fiddling with the income tax, you're really not addressing the tax that affects most workers, that affects most Americans. So the main benefit of this change, and I should say that simplicity in the tax code isn't the same as fairness. In fact, that those two concepts can be in conflict and actually are in conflict. You obviously don't want an overly complex tax code that people can hide in, but the simplest tax obviously would be a head tax. You say everyone pays $100. That's very simple, but it's not very fair, because then you have Bill Gates paying the same thing as a minimum wage worker. So the idea of having different brackets is a way of distinguishing the different abilities of people to pay based on how much money they make. So as soon as you start cutting out brackets, you're by definition making the tax code less fair.
And you know, and I'm glad you brought that up, because when people see, oh, all I'm going to have to pay is 15% tax, you know, they maybe don't read the whole sentence of federal income tax, because mm-hmm. most of us pay less than 15% for mm-hmm. federal income tax. We pay our state, our local, the payroll mm-hmm. tax, as you pointed out, all of these things. That's just this one federal tax. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the big numbers, the very wealthy, you know, the people we talked about at the top, they would walk away with a king's ransom.
They would, and we would lose trillions of dollars in revenue, and that's trillions of dollars that can't be used to expand healthcare, can't be used to improve education, can't be used to make childcare affordable for people, can't be used to address the housing crisis that we're facing right now. So when you're cutting federal income taxes, you're just helping the wealthy and you're hurting everyone else, because most people don't pay that much in federal income taxes, and they do often benefit from these services that the federal government pays for and helps people stretch their dollars and live a better life and expand opportunities for them.
Yeah, all that's fine, well and good, fine, well and good. But we could get our billionaire class to $10 trillion. Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, I mean, if we just want to sit around and cheer the billionaire class, I guess that's okay. That's kind of how Rome went down, though. You know, we'd be cheering demigods, I guess, as our roads crumbled and our kids weren't being educated and our grandparents weren't getting any health care. It's really a choice. It's really a choice of what we want to do. And I think that the American people have made their choice, quite frankly.
No, we're going to make our choice in November, because this is one of those issues very clear where each side stands. There is no ambiguity. There's no gray area. It is a complete and total. There's no, it's night and day.
Yeah.
It seems that simple to me. But hey, maybe we do want our billionaire class to get to $10 trillion. And as I've been saying for a long time, I'm waiting for someone to come out with billionaire trading cards so we can mm-hmm. all have our favorites. We can trade them. We can have like a dream team of billionaires. It would be fabulous. Granted, we won't be able to eat or have a roof over our head, but we got billionaires, man. So last question I've got for you, you know, on this front, you know, this isn't a sexy topic. A lot of people aren't, you know, running to the local bar to debate tax policy with their friends. Why is this important, do you think?
we can't pay for anything unless we raise the money. I mean, we have a huge national debt. The Republicans use that as an excuse to try to cut things, including Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So whatever you care about, if you care about schools, if you care about hospitals, if you care about national defense, if you care about law enforcement, if you care about science, if you care about anything that we collectively pay for through our federal government, we have to raise more money. And the people who have the money are those billionaires with their $6 trillion and people just below them. And the Biden-Harris administration has been the most progressive tax reforming administration in recent American history. And every indication is that Kamala Harris will continue that. There's lots of ways to raise money from people who have too much of it right now. And I think she's the one who's going to offer those solutions in this coming campaign.
Well, we'll see. But, you know, it does sound enticing, $10 trillion. Just kind of throwing it out there. Will, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you, my friend.
Yeah, great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Will Rice, policy consultant there at Americans for Tax Fairness. I was joking about the $10 trillion thing. It's a disgrace that it's at $6 trillion. It's a national disgrace. That simple. Check out their website, AmericansForTaxFairness.org. Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1968. That was the first day of a new U.S. labor partnership, the Alliance for Labor Action. The alliance was forged by the president of the United Auto Workers, Walter Reuther, and the president of the Teamsters Union, Frank Fitzsimmons. The UAW had left the AFL-CIO over differences on how to approach labor organizing. The newly formed alliance with the Teamsters stood as a progressive alternative to the AFL-CIO's approach at the time. The ALA called for forming community unions for the millions of poor and unorganized workers. It supported the civil rights movement, as well as the movement against the war in Vietnam. One of the ALA's slogans was, quote, to find answers to the urgent problems of our society. The ALA developed position papers on a series of issues. One of those urgent problems was health care. The ALA described, quote, the United States is the last remaining industrialized country in the world which does not have a national health insurance plan which would assure all its citizens at least minimum guarantee of access to needed medical care. In 1969, the ALA launched its first major organizing drive in Atlanta, Georgia. The drive targeted multiple industries and included a massive advertising campaign. But the Atlanta business community stood in staunch opposition to the unionization effort. Despite some successes, the Atlanta effort did not garner the hoped-for results. The ALA suffered another blow when Walter Reuther died in a plane crash in May of 1970. The alliance disbanded in 1972. Universal health care and many of the other causes championed by the ALA remain unrealized.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, $6 trillion. In the hands of about 1,200 people? I mean, you could literally put those people in a good-sized room, and $6 trillion, when the vast majority of people in this country have nothing saved for retirement, have no rainy day fund, a $400 emergency sends them into chaos. It's crazy. It's just crazy the way our tax code has been structured to make sure that the wealthy and the powerful, I guess it isn't crazy. We have allowed them to control our government for way too long. Just amazing. Now, yesterday, I fell down one of the video crack rabbit holes. And I don't do this often. I don't allow myself to do it very often. But I was just sitting around and I just happened to be scrolling through and it got me thinking about the world that we've been trained to think is kind of normal. And you know, I grew up, you know, as a kid in the 70s, came of age in the 80s, and, you know, things were much different back then. And there was a video that grabbed my attention, just of this little guy who was harassing this big guy about not taking his shopping cart to some designated area. Or he basically just put the cart up over the curb and got in his car and drove off. And the guy was just, this little guy was just berating him up and down, you know, every which way, you know, calling him everything but a decent human being. And it got me to thinking of, you know, in the age of video cameras, we see a lot of this kind of stuff. You know, I dare you to do something and I bet you won't kind of videos, which are trying to bait people into confrontations or some kind of violence so they can sue or whatever. Because back in my day, that happened in the parking lot. One of two things would have happened. The guy who was being harassed would have probably taken care of the person, or the guy whose job it was to take the carts back would have gotten in it. And the video got me thinking about my first paycheck paying job. It was in a small local department store chain in Cleveland. It was called Uncle Bill's. For my Cleveland audience, Uncle Bill's, yay. There were like four or five of them in the greater Cleveland area. They got bought out by some, you know, big company at the time, Cook United, who ended up, you know, eventually, you know, the big moneyed interest sucked everything out of it and put them out of business in 87. But my grandmother had made a career out of that little store, and a lot of families did. And it was a good paying, you know, family sustaining wage job for people who needed the income. And one of the people that I remember, because of this video of this guy, you know, just going up and down. And I guess this is a thing. This cart shaming, I guess, is a thing. I remember a guy named Freddie Weber. Freddie was he was disabled. He had a really bad case of Tourette's. And his job, what he got up every day to do, was to go get the carts. His job was to make sure the carts were clean, you know, pick up some stuff in the parking lot. And nobody took more pride in the job that they did than Freddie Weber did. And this video got me thinking about, had someone wanted to take the cart back, Freddie probably would have beat him up for taking it back. And it just shows how we've been changed in our thinking, that used to be someone's job. You know, much like, you know, I go to the checkout counter at the supermarket and someone is shaming me for not using the self-checkout. It's this same kind of thing that we're being trained every day to think, well, that's a menial job. You know, no, that's somebody's livelihood. And I guess I'm one of the only people who think like this, or I think I am. Email me if I'm not, because I want to hear that there are others out here who think that, you know what? People need jobs all along the spectrum of capabilities. And Freddie Weber, his job was, and did it for, I think, like 45 or 50 years. His job every day was to go out and get the carts. He would wash them down. He'd wipe them down, clean everything up. He'd go out and clean up the parking lot. But the pride he took in that, in knowing that, here's the thing, if he was at work, you knew there wasn't a cart in the parking lot. Because he would basically follow you out, take it back from you. There were never two carts somewhere. He'd run and get them. But it was that sense of, this is my job. This is how I put food on my table. And people respected that back then. And fought for that. Look, when Freddie Weber wasn't there, you know, chaos happened. And people want to know, where is he? And I guess the reason I'm sharing this is because, you know, I see us in a much different light than maybe we were back in the early to mid 80s. I think back then maybe people cared a little bit more about each other. I could be wrong. Maybe it's just what I'm seeing. But on this job front, because we're going to see a lot of jobs being lost and quickly. When the AI and the robotics and the automation and all that stuff come online, it's going to be rapid. It's going to be painful. And it's going to be shameful. And this is where my mind goes. I do think we've got to protect those jobs that people take pride in. And I guess that's my message on that, which is why when I go to a place where there is a checkout person, I go to their counter. It may take an extra 20 or 30 seconds, but you know what? They take pride in what they do. And that's how they feed their families. Just my thought. Want to hear yours? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Podcast. Also, freespeech.org. Check out the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickssmithshow.com.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.